And welcome again to Cottage Talk. I am Russ Goldman, and co-hosting with me today is Andrew Beck and David Kettlehake. This is another edition of the Cottagers Confidential Roundtable. It's an end-of-the-season episode. We're going to be talking about several things related to the end of the season. But before we do anything else, I have to welcome my co-hosts back to the show. First, let me introduce the editor of Cottagers Confidential, Andrew Beck. Andrew, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Okay. Well, Andrew, you don't sound too excited to be talking today.
Well, it's I would be doing much better if the playoffs had went a little bit differently.
I'm there with you, my friend. And listen, we'll be talking a little bit about that final match in just a bit. And then we're going to be talking about end of the season situations. And then we'll be ending the show by talking about how you became a fan, myself, and then, of course, David as well. That's how we're going to end the show. So it should be fun. But before we do anything, I have to welcome our other co-host back to the show. It's been a long time. Mr. Kettlehake, how you doing?
Hi, Russ. Thanks for having me back. It's really good to be back on with you and Andrew again.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I had hoped to do more episodes of the Cottagers Confidential Roundtable, but life does get in the way, and we all have busy schedules. But I am glad that we could do an end-of-the-season episode, and we're going to be talking about several different topics, but we have to start with talking about the last match. And Andrew, I'm going to start with you. It's been a little over 2 weeks. I'm still hurting from it. I'm sure David's hurting as well. Let's just get your overall view. I don't want to spend too much time talking about the last match, but just give me your thoughts about this last match, like I said, a little over 2 weeks ago.
Well, the Reading fans won't be wanting to hear it because they definitely told me about it on Twitter, but it's one of those things where if you play that match exactly the same way 20 times, Fulham probably wins 15 of them by multiple goals. The expected goals, they created more chances than Reading. They created more big chances than Reading. It's just one of those things. Sometimes the goalkeeper stands on his head, and sometimes the referee makes a couple of decisions that don't go in your way, and soccer's such a low-scoring sport that there's a lot of random chance involved, and the breaks just didn't go Fulham's way. I mean, as you saw with Huddersfield, you can get through the entire playoffs without scoring a goal yourself. So
that's right.
You know, that's just the sport. It makes it infuriating, but it also, that's kind of the reason why you love it so much, is that anything can happen on any given day like this. And it's just, you gotta be able to roll with the punches. Otherwise you'll go crazy.
I agree with you, my friend. And listen, not to put salt on the wound, I do have to ask you about the moment of the match and just what was going through your mind when you saw the ball go over the top and there you see Jan Kermigan and Tomas Kalas going after it. And then, of course, the penalty is called for handball. What was going through your mind when you initially saw it?
It's one of those things. It didn't look like a penalty to me. It's one of those, I've seen it called before and I've seen it not called before. And it's just, handballs in the box are like the worst call for me, because the rule says that the guy has to be handling it deliberately. And no one is ever really trying to handle it deliberately unless they're like blocking the ball out of the goal. It's always an accident. But, you know, what is deliberate is so ill-defined in the rule book. I just don't know about them anymore. I see games where I'm like, that should be a penalty and that shouldn't be a penalty, and the referee doesn't agree with either of them. And it's one of these things where if I was the ref, I wouldn't have called it, but it wasn't killing me that it was called. The one from the Danny Williams, where he handled the ball in the leg at Craven Cottage, to me was much, the no call there was much, right. Worse.
It's tough. And off air, we were talking about replay, and we talked about that on the last show. It's something that I was thinking about at the time, and I don't want to spend too much time talking about replay, but it is a situation where it's a tough call, and the ref has a tough call. He made it. But let's be honest here, Andrew, before I go over to David. Fulham did not do enough to win this match or even get a draw. They had their opportunities, but they did not capitalize on their opportunities, and you have to give credit to Ali Al-Habsi. He made some key saves here.
Yeah, I mean, and that's just, sometimes that happens, you know. You're only, the keeper's going to save like 80, 90% of the shots, and because of that, you sometimes you'll get 20 shots and he'll just happen to save them all. It's just that's the sport. And he had a good performance. I mean, I think if you play it a couple of times, Fulham probably win more often than they lose, but you only play it once.
Before I go to David, what were your thoughts about the situation with Lucas Piazon in the box? Mike Gregg didn't think it was a penalty. You know, he goes down. What were your thoughts about that?
To me, that was iffy. It's one where I've seen it called and I've seen it not called. People will say, well, he went down too easy and he shouldn't have went down there. My biggest problem with that is that if you don't fall down, you never get the call. I've watched a couple of games this year where I bet it live, where a player is literally getting drugged down from behind, but he keeps trying to run and he gets a shot off before he falls down and the shot goes wide and the referee just, you know, says a goal kick. And I'm like, if you just fallen down, it's a penalty. So he's getting punished for doing the right thing. So, I mean, right. I understand why players go down easy like that. And I don't think how easy or not a player goes down should decide whether or not it's a penalty. A foul is a foul, should be a foul anywhere on the pitch. And I thought it was probably a foul, but, you know, I could see the argument where it's not.
Okay. Very good there, my friend. All right. Over to you, Mr. Kettlehake. I'm sorry we have to revisit this, but I want to get your thoughts on the match.
Well, first of all, congratulations to Huddersfield, because had Reading won, I probably would have walked out into traffic because I just could not have handled them winning the whole thing. Even if they had won with their style of play, they would have come right back down. But regardless, I had to listen to the first half because my daughter had scheduled, unbeknownst to me, a photography session for our family. So I had to listen to the first half in the car. And the beginning of the second half, when I heard the penalty come on at the 50th minute with Callis, I, of course, didn't see it. I just heard it. My thought at the time was, that's okay. We go down 1-0, probably more than any other team. And right. More often than not, we're able to tie it up or come back and win. So I didn't get to see the actual penalty until much later. That's a rough one. Andrew said it very well when, you know, the prior match, that was a much clearer handball than against Callis. And I'm not one for replay, but, you know, because I feel that in most cases, this evens itself out in time. I'm a big fan of goal line technology, but I'm not a big fan of replay. But damn, it still hurt. And, you know, it's 2 weeks later, and I have not gone back and watched any part of that match since then. I just can't do it. And with the amount of pressure we put on them at the end, Martin's missed header, a couple other things, you know, like Andrew said, a few more things. If something else had gone our way, would have been a whole different story, but it wasn't. It's not. And that was it. Great season. Yep. Wonderful season. So good to be looking up instead of looking down. But still, it's still a little painful. My wife asked me if I was going to cry afterwards, and I didn't answer her.
It was hard, and you and I talked about this. I've actually watched it a few times since then, and I don't know why.
I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, I have no idea why I'm doing that. You know, again, I would like to be prepared for doing the podcast, so I watched it again for the last podcast, and it was difficult to watch back. But I want to ask you this, because this is something that Emilio said in the last show that stands out to me. It's a fine line. You guys are talking about how Huddersfield Town went through, and it's such a small, thin line, the difference between winning and losing and getting to that final, and then ultimately gaining promotion through the playoffs. It's so tight. Emilio mentioned in the first leg, the miss by Sonny Aluko. I'm going to ask you this, David. If he scores there, and he scored in a similar situation during the season,
sure,
could everything be different? It's a fine line. If
different.
He scores there, do you know what I'm talking about?
Everything. Absolutely. Everything's different. I mean, you bag that goal like that, and it changes the entire tenor of the game because, I mean, you know, Reading or not, we would call prolific scorers. You know, I'm looking at my sheet right here. What did they have? 68 goals. We had 85. I mean, come on. They're not. The problem that I see that we suffered through, and I don't care if it was Blackburn or a couple, you know, Reading, you know, a few other teams, and we've said this before. I've heard Mike Gregg and Emilio and everybody talk about it, is we had no plan B. You know, there was no other option for us if they were, and they weren't parking the bus, but if they were really shutting us down with the way we play and the way, yep, you know, the fluid, wonderful style of football that we play, we didn't have a good way to get through that. And that was, in my opinion, our downfall this year. I know people say, you know, well, if we scored more penalties, because we were so bad at that, you know, that would have been it. And I did a quick little analysis of penalties and where they came and where they would have made a difference. From what I can figure out, if we had scored crucial penalties, we would have gained an additional 7 points.
Wow.
And Brighton would have dropped 2. So they would have been at 91 and we would have been at 87. That's still not enough.
Still not enough. Yeah.
So, you know, we had to find a way through those tough, tough, boring games, you know, with tough defense. And we just couldn't do that. So that was the problem here. You know, we had, what, 19 shots, 6 on target that last match. Al Hobsey was insanely good. But, yeah, if we're going to go to the next level, you know, we have to be able to adjust and do things a little bit differently to get through those really tough, grinding matches.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, David. It's winning ugly. We were talking about that on the last show. But I'm going to throw something out to both of you while we're talking about this, because we'll be talking about it in a little bit of needs for next season. Emilio, again, mentioned this. I can't remember the words he used, but he was really describing a difference maker, someone that you can count on to score goals. The player I think of the most is with Brighton, Glenn Murray, that you can count on to get that goal. They were missing an out-and-out striker that you can count on. You know, I thought Chris Martin was going to be that guy. I got to be honest with you, but it wasn't him. They needed someone to be able to consistently do that in crucial situations, to be able to step up and take over a game when they needed to. What are your thoughts on that? You know, and again, keep going back to the striker position, but I'll just say that maybe, you know, again, I think it's a striker, but I also think it's just a goal scorer, a consistent goal scorer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's really funny. I looked back, and I think Andrew and I did this show, this exact show, a year ago right now.
Yep.
And you asked then, what are the top 3 positions Fulham need to upgrade this summer, so this coming year? And I said, pace.
And they did that.
You know, and look, and we did. I mean, we got Stefjo, we got Fredericks, we got Malone. And look at the difference. You know, Sessegnon, look at the difference those guys made. You know, Aluko, these absolute, you know, speed machines that may have had their faults in other ways. You know, Malone's crosses were not great. You know, Fredericks got a bit of a temper problem. But the speed is, and we added that, and look at the difference it made. So, you know, my key upgrades for next year would be, and this is tough to say because he's been a really, really good steward of the club, you know, we probably still need a better keeper. It was very bold and had to be a terribly difficult decision for Slavisa to take Button out and put Bettinelli in, but I mean, he did so much better, but he's still probably not as good as you need. And my second one was a bona fide striker. So, yeah, Martin was not it, you know?
No, he wasn't. And listen, he scored some crucial goals, and we could talk about what happened with Derby County screwing everything up, because I think that was a factor. But still,
karma's a bitch.
It wasn't good enough. David and Andrew, I want to get your thoughts on this, because when you look at it and you look at the fine lines, and we're talking about a plan B, and I'm glad that David mentioned a plan B, because I think that they definitely need a plan B. But I will also throw on this question to you. Was not having that proven goal scorer, and we can call it a striker, whatever you want to say, that you could count on in a match like this, in a match like the first leg, was that the difference here?
Maybe. I'm always hesitant when someone says we need to get a proven goal scorer, because, you know, Darren Bent was a proven goal scorer, and, you know, then he was Darren Bent. That seems to happen a lot when you go out and try to get the proven guy.
Right.
I think the Fulham not having a plan B, that was really a problem earlier in the year. And I think they, to some extent, they kind of got by that in the second half of the year. When the teams would shut it down, they would start playing a little bit more direct. And I think that was a key to when they went on that really good run at the end of the year. They've kind of figured out how to deal with teams, you know, packing it in against them. It's just, well, we'll be slightly more direct. We're going to keep the ball, but we are going to try a few more, you know, dangerous passes, a few more long balls, a few more through balls. You just need a few of those, and all of a sudden the defense starts having to honor that, and it makes it much harder for them to pack it in. Against Reading, it wasn't so much that what we were doing wasn't working. It's just, you know, we didn't finish. And then Reading is one of the harder teams to play, not because they pack it in, but simply because they use possession much more as a defensive weapon than they do an offensive weapon. Whereas Fulham tries to keep the ball where they're trying to create chances and score. Reading is just trying to keep the ball so you don't have it. And there were times in the game where Reading would get on a little bit of a run and get the ball for a little bit and keep it just so Fulham couldn't have it. I mean, Reading never really looked particularly dangerous to me in either leg. They had a couple of chances, but I mean, for the most part, I think the games kind of went the way Fulham wanted. It's just El Hobsi, you know, stood on his head in the second leg. We missed a couple of easy chances in the first leg. And I agree with you earlier. If Sonny Aluko scores in the beginning of that game, I think Fulham wins that game, scores three or four goals in that game. And
then
everything's completely different. Reading showed over the season that they are awful if they don't score first. I think they won twice all year and never on the road when they conceded the first goal.
You know, listen, it's a great point, Andrew, and it's something that I mentioned in the lead up to both of these matches, that them scoring the first goal was massive for them, and it proved out in both legs. It did. It's unfortunate, but I keep going back to the missed opportunities, and you have to give Reading credit. You've talked about how they play and how Ali Hobsi played. He played great. Don't want to take anything away from him. But if we convert and, like, you know, go back to what Emilio said to me, if unfortunately got to go back there, if Aluko scores there, everything's different. But it didn't turn out that way, and now we move on. But before we move on, guys, I want to look at the end of the season. I have some topics I want to talk about. We talked about on the last show of Cottage Talk, player of the season. I shared mine, and mine is Kevin McDonald. But I want to get your player of the season, and Andrew, I'm going to start with you.
For me, it's kind of a toss-up between McDonald and Stefan Johansson. And I lean towards Stefan Johansson simply because the way he came in and, he started that first game and got pulled after, 26 minutes for tactical reasons. And it just looked like, oh, my God, who did we buy here? Were all those Celtic fans who said he's garbage, were they right? And then after that, he came back in, he rejoined the team, and that's really when things, at least offensively, I saw things really turn it around for Fulham, because his ability to kind of play both ways, but he plays both ways really well, but unlike someone like Scott Parker, when he's trying to make a pass, he's always looking to try to make a really, really good killer pass, whereas Scott Parker is looking not to give the ball away, and Johansson just had a little bit more of that, I'm going to try something. And sometimes it didn't work, but a lot of times it did. And that was very, very important. And it's really, really hard to find a guy who can go both ways as well as he can. Like Kevin McDonald was great. He was just about the perfect holding midfielder. But there are a lot of guys who can be good holding midfielders out there. And Tom Carney was a great attacking midfielder. But again, when you're saying we just want you to be an attacking midfielder. There's a lot of guys who can do that. The guy, finding a guy who can do go both ways, like Johansson did, that's really, really hard to get.
I understand why you went with Johansson. That would have been my second pick. But I went with McDonald, and maybe it's just a style thing of the type of player that I like, Andrew. I like the gritty player, the worker bee, and he's the ultimate worker bee. So that's why I went with him. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and you can tell just, I mean, Fulham, what did they give up? I think 40 goals less, something like that this year than last year, something near that. And a lot of that reason is Kevin McDonald. I mean, we're playing our fullbacks didn't really get upgraded that much defensively. You know, we were playing Tim Ream at center back for most of the year. So we didn't do a whole lot of upgrading of the defense. I mean, and even Callis, well, who was had a really good year, he missed a lot of time. The big reason the defense was so much better was just Kevin McDonald back there being the shield and, you know, holding onto the ball and making a lot of Fulham's offense work. And he was great. I mean, he would be my second pick.
Okay, very good there, my friend. All right, David, over to you. Your thoughts. Who would be your player this season?
You know, it's always bound to come down to with this group, with one of the tremendous trio, you know, of Steph, Joe, McDonald, or Tom Kearney. And I ended up going with Stefan Johansson for player of the season as well, much for the same reasons that Andrew said so. I mean, you looked at that first match when he got the hook after 30 minutes, whatever it was, and I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, you know, cursing, you know, Tony Khan and Craig Klein, you know, what are you doing? Who is this guy? And then after that, he was, I wouldn't say unstoppable, but man, he was close. You know, you had McDonald back there, who I like to call the silent assassin. Yep. You know, he was just taking care of business all across the back midfield. And Steph Joe was just, you'd see him pressing people, pressing the keeper. You'd see him going after balls that no one else would bother. And just being a menace the entire time and never slowing down. The man's energy level is just amazing. And you're right, you know, with great passing, good vision, and just an overall great player. So I know, you know, it's going to be Tom Kearney is going to be number one, and I don't have a problem with that whatsoever. I mean, the man, you know, hopefully if he stays with us, he's already bordering on legendary, and he's going to be that way. But I did appreciate the play of Stefan Johansson because of his, you know, his energetic and unstoppable play. And I heard Amelia or somebody mention in your last podcast, you know, there were times when, you know, Tom Kearney was somewhat invisible. You know, you wouldn't, if you were listening to Gentleman Jim, you wouldn't hear his name called out for 5, 10, whatever minutes at a time, but you know, Johansson, Steph Joe was always there. So, you know, any one of those three are very deserving of the player of the season.
See, I totally agree with that. We were talking about that, is the three of them being like the three musketeers, and that's really what they were. They all feed off of each other, and the three of them are vital to work together as a unit. And But I go with Kevin McDonald. I just think that it all starts with him. Shading the back four, protecting them, and then starting the play from him. I think it all starts from him. And then it goes to Johansson, and then it goes to Kearney. But it begins with him. He's the rock. That's why I went with McDonald. All right, guys, let's move on. And David, I'm going to go back to you. I'm going to switch things around a little bit because I want to end this section talking about Slavisa. So now we're going to talk about building the team throughout this season. So give me your rating from 1 to 10 for Tony Khan on being in charge of building the squad with his both boxes checked system. What would you give him for an overall rating?
My rating for Tony, well, it really depends on what time of the year we're asking that, but right now it's going to be an 8. And not just building the squad, but his involvement, him coming into the Fulham Supporters Trust dinner, him, you know, tweeting, you know, his support, being at the matches there near the end, just really showing some passion for the club, really bodes well for, you know, where we're going to go. So, I mean, I did an article at the beginning of the season on an interview that he gave, and yeah, he was a very likable fellow in that interview. And I know you've had him on the show as well, and he came across very well on that too. I know there was a lot of fear and angst about the two boxes checked system, but you know, besides a couple that haven't really worked out, he's really worked out well. I mean, look at some of these players that he's brought in. 3/4 of them, when we signed them, I looked around and went, who the hell is this? And, you know, it just ends up that they just, for the most part, you know, 75, 80% of them worked out tremendously well. So eight and a half for Tony. And, you know, bring in a couple of more for next season and power to you. I think that's great. So, yeah, 8 to 8.5. For me.
David, before I go over to Andrew and get his rating for Tony, what's interesting here, and I'm glad that you talked about next season, there was a huge job of revamping this squad with all the players that they brought in. You're not going to hit 100%. You're going to, like you said, maybe hit 75 to 80%. If you're doing that, that's excellent, and I think that's what
that's
he
great.
Did. But the bigger point that you just mentioned I think is important. The base is already there. He's built the base. Now you just have to add to the base. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I remember on your show you asked him, I think what was it, January when you had him on? You said,
I believe it was March.
You know, March, you know, we talked, it was the end of the transfer window was over and we were talking and you were talking and you asked him about, you know, why didn't you bring in a striker? And he kind of said, we don't need one. We've got what we need. And, you know, if you look at the style of play that we had and how the goals were spread out, I know I'm contradicting myself a little bit from before when I said, boy, I would really like to have a bona fide striker. and he wasn't all wrong. You know, had we, and it's almost as if I'm pulling out my checkbook, which I'm not, but had we lavished out some money and picked up somebody, you know, with the attributes that we're looking for, you know, could that have made a difference in the end? You know, we'll never know. But, you know, the system is not doing too badly right now. When you have a full overhaul, when you go from, oh God, what were we last year, 19th or 20th, you know, all the way up to 6th in one season, you're not doing too bad.
No, you're not. You're definitely not. And that's why I wanted to talk about it, because I think that he's done a very good job building the squad, not just for what he did this season, but I think it sets us up nicely for next season if we keep our key players. Andrew, yeah. Over to you. Give a rating for Tony Khan.
I'd say 8.5 or 9. I mean, when you look at the transfers that they made, especially in the summer window, the only two guys, I mean, I guess the only two guys I'd really heard of, you could say I knew of Lucas Piazon, but I wasn't a huge fan of his. The only two guys that I really knew about and were fans of were Josebed and Sigurdsson. And those are the two guys that didn't work. He found all these guys that I'd never heard of and guys that I was never like a fan, like a Luco and Piazon, who I'm like, oh, these guys are just kind of okay. They've never been able to like stick around anywhere. And they all fit. They all did what they were supposed to do.
Okay.
And that's just doing that is kind of amazing. Whatever they're doing, they just need to keep doing it. And yeah, now they've got such a good base, and the players they bought are all of the kind of ages where you don't really have to worry about them, you know, going into next year being too old, because they were all either just coming into their prime or still in their prime. So now you just have to plug a few holes. It's like, well, we really need another center back, and we really need maybe especially like a striker, a change of pace striker. So you just have a few little things that you have to go out and get. Whereas last year, I mean, I think the first game we started, 10 of the 11 guys weren't on the squad.
Yeah.
The year before. So, I mean, we're definitely not going to see that next year.
No. No, and that's the point, Andrew, and when we talk about next season, we'll be talking about that in just a bit. That's what's interesting, because I'm going to ask you guys three positions of need, and there are three positions of need, but if you look at the overall view of the team going into next season right now, if it stays the way it is right now, they're in really good shape, Andrew.
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, the I mean, we'll probably get to talk about this later, but, you know, if they lose Thomas Kalas, that's kind of a big hurt. They'll definitely need to go out and replace him. So they'll need two center backs instead of one center back. But, I mean, in reality, if we were to say if Kalas could become permanent, you're looking at, you really need to buy a center back, and you need, what else do you need? A center back, and you need, like, a change of pace striker. That's really kind of it. You know, maybe plug in some depth, but I mean, other than that, the team's pretty well set, and maybe a goalkeeper. I'm still not convinced that Bettinelli can't do the job if given the job for the whole year, and he's young enough where you would expect him to actually get better the more he plays. So I'm not convinced he can't be the guy, but I could definitely see the point in going out and getting another goalkeeper.
I'm with both of you on that, because when David said that, that's actually been in my mindset too, goalkeeper. But we'll talk about that in just a bit. Before we do that, let's now talk about Savisa. And I want to get a rating from you, from 1 to 10. His job last season overall.
Again, he's going to get like an 8 or 9 from me. I mean, the only downsides I can see to him is he was a little slow a couple times to figure a few things out. He was a little slow in figuring out that when we were up against a team that was just going to bunker and really make us break them down, he was a little slow to recognize that just being a little bit more direct in those times could really open up the game. It took Fulham a few games to really just change the way they were playing. But you could see it in these games where early in the season, they would go up against a bunkering team and they would complete like 92% of their passes. And in later in the season, when they're going up a bunkering team, they'd only be completing like 77 to 80% of their passes. So they're still completing a very high percentage, but they're not as much. And it didn't actually hurt their possession. They were possessing the ball just as much, but they were just trying a few harder passes. So I thought he was a little bit slow there. And I think he was a little bit slow to decide on what his back line should be. I mean, his system really requires at least two guys who can play the ball with their feet. And you could maybe get away with only having one center back who can't play the ball with his feet if you have a keeper who could. But we kind of saw that our keeper was not really great at distribution. So he kind of settled into Tim Ream and Kalas by default. But there was a lot of shuffling. He was trying a lot of things. And I think in hindsight, I think he probably could have settled a little bit faster. If he'd settled a little bit faster, I think Fulham maybe gets a few more points earlier in the season. But, I mean, okay, those are like nitpicks. I mean, it's like he found the right answer. It just maybe took him a game longer than I think it should have. And I'm looking for things to try to find wrong. All in all, it's really hard to find much fault with what he did.
Okay, very good there. All right. Over to you, David. Rating for Savisa.
Yeah, I'm with Andrew again. I have marked down here a 9, and really a couple things jumped out at me over the season. Number one, the way he handled the Chris Martin debacle was nothing short of amazing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, when you look at his statements back then, there was nothing fuzzy, you know, fuzzy and murky about what his intentions were. Chris Martin is our player. He is staying with us. Next question. And you know, you just knew that nothing was going to happen. He was going to sit him no matter what. He was not going to let him go back to Derby no matter what. And I really appreciated the way that he handled that. That was the one thing. Another thing is, I absolutely loved his behavior after a game, after a match, win or lose, usually win, when they're asked, you know, the reporters and, you know, everybody in the press are asking about you know, what's going to happen the next couple games? What's going on next? How, what about the playoffs? And he would just go, we're just focused on the next game. That's it. And his focus was laser on that next match and what he needed to do to win. And he was just so, so strong and so good at that. My only, really, like Andrew said, this is kind of nitpicking, but really, I give him credit for making the Button Bettinelli switch, because that's tough. I mean,
I've coached.
That's hard. I've coached football. I haven't for a while now, but I did for years. And that's one of the hardest things. When you have a set player in there and you have to make that call, that's why he gets the big bucks, but you have to make that call. You know, in hindsight now, and it is hindsight, I wish he had done it earlier, because, you know, when somebody would pass back to Button, you know, especially in the early days, you know, he looked as, you know, as comfortable as, you know, me juggling flaming torches. it was just not, it wasn't his style, and it wasn't a good fit. Bettinelli handled that a lot better. And really, from the time that he came in, you know, we really took off, you know, even more after that. So, you know, maybe, again, like Andrew said, making some changes earlier on, settling on the squad. I mean, if you look at the September to Never Remember that we had, I have to look back at, if I were to pay attention to each of these matches individually and see that, I'm sure there are things that he could have done differently at that point to make a difference. But again, you also have to look at it compared to what we've had in the past. Kit Simons, great steward of the club, not a great manager. And then, of course, the crazy German before that. So according, you know, compared to that, Slavisa was just, you know, a wonder. So I give him a 9.
Okay, and I understand why you would. And I think if we're marking him down like you guys are talking about, nitpicking a little bit, but it's warranted. You know, I agree with where you guys were going on that. All right, let's transition. We've talked about end of the season. Let's now start looking at next season. David, I'm going to go right back to you. We just started talking about Slavisa. I have to ask you this question because there's speculation. There's probably going to be speculation the entire summer. He's a good coach. This is going to happen. Let me ask you just a simple question. Do you think Slavisa stays with Fulham this season, upcoming?
I'm going to say yes. And I would like to put an asterisk after that if I could.
Okay.
Because if you look back at his coaching history, and I'm going to mutilate these names, and I apologize to all the teams that I'm about to mutilate, but Peritzen, he was there from 2007 to 2009. Wangsong, 2012 to 13. Levke, 2013. Hercules, 2014. Watford, 2014 to 2015. Maccabi, 2015. And then us. So seven teams in 10 years. So he is, you know, he's no Arsene Wenger. You know, he's no Sir Alex. You know, he moves around a lot. I'm hoping that the cons have made it worth his while to stay. And I think, I hope that he looks at this as a job not completed, and he wants to come back and complete this job. I know there are clubs out there, Crystal Palace and whoever else, who would love to have him. I'm just hoping that he holds his hand up, says no, and they move on.
That's what I'm hoping, my friend. I was glad to see the Watford job be filled, and now I'm hoping that the Crystal Palace job gets filled and we can just move on. But, of course, there are other leagues as well around the world that could be interested in him. It's just something that we have to watch. I agree with you. I think he stays, but I think we have to have the conversation. For one of the reasons
we do.
You just
mentioned.
I mean,
he's got a thing for Spanish clubs. I mean, you know.
He does.
He does. I mean, I believe his spoken Spanish is much better than his spoken English, for comfort's sake. And at one time, I don't remember which club he had gone to, but his family never left Spain when he moved on for a while. So hopefully he's well settled in London and, you know, wants to feel that he didn't complete the job this time, and he wants to stick around until he does.
I hope so. I really do, my friend, because I think he's the one piece of the puzzle that Fulham desperately need to hold on to. And I just, like I said, hope that these jobs continually get filled and he just says no. But it's something that we just have to talk about. Andrew, over to you. Your thoughts. Do you think Slavisa ultimately stays with Fulham for the upcoming season?
I think he starts the season with Fulham for sure. The only job I could see him possibly taking is Crystal Palace, but I've been hearing them linked to some bigger names. The amount of money in the Premier League right now is kind of throwing the entire football world out of whack, because anyone in the Premier League, and some of that money does float down to the Championship as well, makes it so that teams at the bottom of the Premier League can pay more money for players and coaches than everyone but the like three or four biggest teams in the top four leagues. So Crystal Palace can pay almost as much for players as, let's say, like Atletico Madrid. The only people in La Liga that can even compete with a low table Premier League team are Barcelona and Real Madrid. It's the same way in Germany. It's the same way in Italy. It's because of that huge TV contract. So even in the Championship, he's going to make probably as much money as he would going to a mid-table club in any of the other big leagues. And, you know, making the money, I mean, it's not the most important thing, but it's a big deal when you have to take a pay cut to go to one of these other leagues. Right. What I'm a little bit worried about is if Fulham have another good year again, and they're around Christmas time or, you know, November, they're at the top of the league. That's when you start to see Premier League managers getting sacked. And I could very easily see a Premier League team sacking their manager, let's say Swansea City, who they went through, what, three managers this year, Watford, although I don't think he would go back to Watford. I could say that, Houghton at Brighton, because I think both Brighton and Huddersfield are going to have big, big issues.
Yeah, I think they're going to struggle.
Billick at West Ham could be in trouble. There's a lot of guys. I think Tony Pulis's luck might finally run out. There's a lot of guys that are going to be in trouble. And again, even Leicester City, if they start off bad again, they might want to switch managers. Then he'll be very attractive to a lot of those teams. So that's my bigger worry, is that someone comes and poaches him in, you know, November or December.
Wow. I wasn't even thinking about that. I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's a valid thing to think about.
I'm terrified, Andrew.
Well, yeah, it's just there's only one opening in the Premier League, and I just don't see him going.
He has a good point for bringing that up, though.
Yeah, I just don't see him going, leaving for a league outside of the Premier League. Okay. I just don't think that. I don't think going to a mid-table club in Spain or Germany or Italy really takes his career to another level. He'll probably make more money in the Championship, and it's much easier to go from the Championship to the Premier League than it is the other way around, from one of those other leagues to the Premier League.
Okay, Andrew, now you've scared me. You scared David, but that's okay.
Damn it, Andrew.
I understand, because I'm glad that you brought that up, because it's something that we have to be cognizant of, even if we get through this summer, like you mentioned, when you're getting towards November, December. There will be jobs probably opening up, and that's probably the next time that you would have to look at it. So I'll have my radar up around that time, so it's a good point by you to bring that up. All right, I'm going to go back to you. Let's now talk about, again, we're looking forward towards the next season. Do you think Fulham hold on to their key players after the summer transfer window ends? We've already seen speculation with Ryan Sessegnon and, of course, Tom Kearney. So I'm just going to ask your opinion on this. What do you think happens after the transfer window ends? Do Fulham hold on to their key players? What do you think?
I think most of them. I don't see Kearney going. Once again, I mean, he would make more money going to the Premier League, and money is important. I don't think he would play that often on most Premier League sides. The sides that he could play a lot for are going to be the sides that are kind of in the bottom half and in trouble of relegation. He's also just not kind of the the prototypical Premier League player. He's not big. He's not fast. He's the kind of guy who would do really, really well, I think, if you put him on Tottenham and you like told him to play like Christian Eriksen. He would do that role very, very well. The problem is that Tottenham can go, you know, buy the $50 million version of Tom Kearney to do that role.
Right.
They don't need Tom Kearney. They need, you know, the $50 million version of him. So he's one of those things where I think he's in a hard place where the kind of teams that he would do well on are not the kind of teams that would be looking to purchase him. So I think he probably stays. Sessegnon, we can talk a little bit more in detail. Because he's under 18, his situation's a little bit trickier. Unless Fulham gets a big fee for him, I don't see them letting him go because of his situation. They do have to let him go. He can't just go sign somewhere else. I see him probably signing a professional contract unless Fulham get, you know, £15 million, something like that for him. And £15 million for him, I think I probably take it. I mean, you can buy a lot of championship players with £15 million. And for a guy who was still probably was only going to start maybe half your games, that's probably good business. Okay. The one guy I really want them to try to keep is Kallas. I really think, because I think it just makes everything harder if you lose Thomas Kallas, because instead of just upgrading one center back, now you need to find two center backs, and you have to worry about starting, you know, two new center backs to begin the year who've never played together before. I would really like to find a way to get him from Chelsea full-time. Chelsea probably have 15 Thomas Kallases on loan around the world, so yeah. I mean, it shouldn't be that hard to get him. But that's the one guy I really do want to see them hold on to.
Okay. Let me go back to you about Sessegnon, because I'm going to throw out this scenario to you. You said if you were offered $15 million for him, you might take it. Well, the only way I take it, if I'm Fulham, that I take that type of offer, if there's a loan back, Andrew, I don't do any of this unless there's a loan back.
Yeah, and I can see that too. And that would especially – that would really depend on where he's going, because I'm guessing the kind of clubs in England that could afford to pay, you know, £15 million plus for him, he's probably not going to play very much there. And he will be playing at a higher level playing with Fulham than he would be playing with someone's U23s.
Right.
Though the one thing I would worry about doing with the loan back is that if the team is, you know, wants to put in, he has to play this many games, or he has to be starting this many games. I wouldn't want to get into a situation where we're forced to play him. I like the way that they kind of brought him on slow. They used him at times as a winger to give him, you know, give him a little bit less defensive responsibility to kind of get his feet wet. I thought they handled bringing him along really, really well. And it's not like Scott Malone. I mean, if he has the same year last year, that's a pretty good left back in the championship to begin with, then. So you don't know how much time he's really going to get.
It's an interesting situation that we're going to have to follow. Like,
yeah,
we were talking about before the show, there's all kinds of speculation with him and Tottenham Hotspur. We're just going to have to see how this all plays out. It's speculation. It's strong speculation. But until something happens, there's still a chance that he could sign a professional contract. And like you mentioned, Fulham still hold some cards here, and they could, you know, get money from him. They could get a significant amount of money for him, but we have to see how this all plays out. So I'm glad that you talked about the situation with Sessegnon and explained it to us. David, your thoughts. Where do you fall on all of this with Fulham's key players coming out of the transfer window? Do Fulham hold on to them?
Well, in one of your previous podcasts, again, I think it might have been Mike Gregg, said about Malone. He said, sell him right now, because he's never going to be better. He's never going to have a better season than he just had.
He did say that.
I mean, it was without a doubt. They don't have the steal of the season as a category on the you know, Fulham website, but that would be it. You know, Malone for Jazz, wow. So, you know, if you do sell him on and you can keep Sessegnon, that'd be great. Give him some more playing time. I still am absolutely baffled that he's only, I mean, he just turned 17 a couple of weeks ago, I think it was.
Just a couple of weeks ago.
I mean, when I was 17, I think I was more concerned with not getting pot drunk by my parents more than anything else. And here he is playing at one of the highest levels of English football. So, you know, you keep the midfield, you keep Kearney. I think he has a great affinity for the club. Andrew laid out some very good reasons why he may or may not, you know, go up to one of the larger Premier clubs that could afford him. We didn't mention yet that he's only one-footed for the most part as well. And if you're going to be playing up at that level, you've got to be, you know, you've got to be a lot better with both
right.
than he is. He's amazing with the left. I've never seen anything like it before.
But he's very one-footed. He's very left-footed.
Yeah, I don't think I saw him take a shot with his right, you know, foot the whole season. And he only had, you know, the one header, I think, header goal the whole season, too. So, you know, the whole Sessegnon thing with Tottenham, you know, if he does go, like you said, Russ, get a loan back. And also, if you can, I don't even know if you can, but get a sell-on clause as well.
Yeah.
Because he could be really good, and we could make a lot of money off of him,
sure.
You know, for a long time to come. You know, Tim Ream in the back. I know he's American. I'm American, so I have a little affinity for him there. But he just came on so one of the most improved players I think in the entire team
this year,
the entire squad, and. For the, you know, he got a lot of stick in the beginning of the season, so I am much more comfortable with him in the back. But you're right. I think Ream and Callas have a pretty good understanding going on. I think they have a really good relationship with Bettinelli as well. So you're going to need to firm that up again with another body or two to have in there in case any of those guys get hurt. Because, again, Callas, he was out a number of games, once or even twice maybe. But yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, we've got such a good core. They seem to be, you know, have a great sense of camaraderie about them. You know, keep most of those guys, and I think we'll be in pretty good shape. I could see, just because of attrition, some people moving on. You know, it just happens. And you know, some of them, you know, may be, you know, like Piazon, he's good. He's not great, but he is a great fan favorite. You know, he's got tremendous passion. He is, you know, he's pretty gifted, but is he phenomenal? Is he, you know, is he as good as we had hoped? I don't know. So you can see some of these, you know, folks moving on, but again, you keep that core of the midfield, couple of those, you know, the backs, you know, Fredericks, yeah, Malone. Yeah, I gave Sonny Aluko a lot of grief about 2 months into the season last year, and right after that, he just took off and became a crazy man. And, you know, you get some scoring boots, you could see a lot more out of him as well. So, yeah, keep 90% of him, and I think, you know, we'll be in pretty good shape and bring on some additional folks
to
bolster the squad. We could be really good.
Oh, and I agree with that. So could you actually see if we're – at the end of the transfer window, let's throw out the names, Sessegnon and Kearney. Could you still see them with Fulham?
Kearney for sure. Sess, I'm not so sure.
Okay, and that's fair.
I have a feeling that he may somehow be going. The allure of some of these big clubs could just be too much. Again, I don't know what his family situation is. I don't know. You know, if they're well off, if they, I have no idea. And the kind of money that can be thrown at him, it may just be too tempting. And thrown at the club may just be too tempting.
Okay.
For that.
That's something to watch. I tend to agree with how you analyze that. Andrew, how about you?
I could definitely see them both being back. I still think that, that Sessegnon probably still does stay. I don't think the amount of salary that he would make going to even being in a club like Tottenham versus what Fulham can offer him would really be that much different. I mean, they do pay higher wages in the Premier League, but most of those higher wages are going to older, more established players. They're not the amount of guys, money a 17-year-old makes in the Premier League versus what a 17-year-old might make in the Championship probably isn't huge. And he's always going, he's got a chance to, you know, he signs a pro deal at Fulham, you know, next summer or this winter, being sold, getting a large chunk of that transfer fee, and then getting a boost in salary again. So, I mean, I think there's a good chance he stays. The only one I'm really worried about leaving that might leave is Callis. I'm not that upset, wouldn't be that upset if Piazon goes. I think he's replaceable. I bet Fulham find a way to get rid of Josebed. And so they probably bring in another central midfielder. But I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of turnover. It's like maybe at goalkeeper, you're either going to need one or two center backs. You might see Maddle or Sigurdsson leave. One of them probably stays on to be the fourth center back. And if Sessegnon goes, you probably need one extra fullback brought in, because right now it would just basically be Doi backing up both spots. But I don't see a whole lot of turnover happening.
I agree with that, and that's going to lead me to talk about positions to upgrade. You pretty much have been talking about them, but I want you to rank them 3-1, your three top positions to upgrade, starting with number three, and one obviously being the one that they desperately need to upgrade. So let's start with three, going all the way down to one.
Starting with three, I'd say probably goalkeeper would be third, the least of the three most important, probably the least. I think Bettinelli can probably do the job, and I think there's a chance that Bettinelli can become a better keeper within a year than any keeper you could actually buy. It's kind of a coin flip. He might not be, but there's a chance that he becomes better than any keeper you could get, and you might have to deal with a few growing pains, but I think that's a possible thing. You can go out and get a good keeper, but there's a chance Bettinelli can turn into something better. So that is kind of where I'm thinking there. Now, if you do hold him, you're probably going to need another keeper, because I don't think our other guys are going to be happy to be backups, you know, just be the second or third keeper. So you're probably still going to see a keeper no matter what. But number two, for me, it's center back. Even if you keep Raymond Callis and you say these are our guys, these are the guys we're going to roll with, we still didn't have a real third center back. Maddle and Sigurdsson both are kind of, I mean, they're much more of like the kind of classic English fullback. They're good in the air. They're big, and that's not the way that Slavisa plays. He wants his guys to defend more with positioning, and he really needs them to be able to handle the ball at their feet and work out of the back. So you really need a third guy, whether that's the guy it takes Reem's spot or is the third center back with a little bit of rotation. Center back, I think, is the most important position, and it probably becomes the first most important position if Callis were to leave. And then my number one is probably striker, though I'm still not certain that we need a starting striker. I don't mind going with, like, you know, some combination of Cabano or Aluko or even Aiete. We're playing like a kind of a very fluid 4-3-3 with three kind of interchangeable guys up top, and I don't mind playing that way at all. But if you're going to do that, you really do need a change of pace kind of guy, whether it's someone like Chris Martin, or ideally what you really need is like the rich man's version of Matt Smith, just kind of a guy who's a change of pace. He's going to come in the last 20 minutes of games when you need goals. In certain games you can start him and he can just, you know, bang around with some center back, just something that allows you to play a slightly different way. You know, I thought Chris Martin could be that guy. He probably could have if it hadn't been for all that derby dust up, but yeah, the kind of the good version of Chris Martin or the rich man's Matt Smith, that's kind of the guy I'd like to bring in, not necessarily to be the starter, but a guy who's going to play a lot and could be a really important player.
Okay, excellent. David, over to you. Your three needs 3-1.
You know, I can't improve on what Andrew said. Keeper, some additional help in the back. And you know, some sort of gifted scorer, whether you want to call him a striker, you know, what. He said it really well, so I'm not going to rehash that because I agree completely. The only thing that I worry about is he's right also in that we do have Adoy who can go play either side if necessary, but he's only one guy. Fredericks has shown at the beginning of the season that he can get hurt and he can also wear out quickly. You know, after 60 minutes of playing time, he got better as the season went on, but he can get tapped out. And once in a while, Malone can have just a pretty mediocre match. So you might need some cover in that area as well. But otherwise, yeah, what Andrew said.
Okay, very good. All right. Guys, let's now end this section. We're talking about automatic promotion. Let's say Fulham are able to do what you guys are talking about with the upgrades. Can Fulham win automatic promotion next season, Andrew?
I don't see any reason why they can't. They were basically the third best team by every advanced stat that you can throw at them almost all season long. Even when they were down in the sixth place, you know, sixth, eighth place, 10th place, they were still, by their goal differential, their expected goals, possession numbers, chances created, they were always looking like one of the best teams. Their offense was the best offense, and their defense was, above average defense. If they improve the defense just a little bit with the way they score goals, they're going to be really, really tough to beat. And I think Slavisa figured a lot of stuff out by the end of the year. The three teams coming down, I'm not particularly scared of any of those teams. I don't think that we're looking at a situation where, like, you had Newcastle who came down and basically threw a Premier League squad into the championship. I mean, they were basically, that was a Premier League squad. They weren't playing change things up and get a lot of championship players. We're not going to have that this year. I think Sunderland is much more likely to be an Aston Villa or a Fulham where they're actually really going to struggle. I think Middlesbrough, they showed that they still have a good defense, but they can't score goals against better competition. And there's only so long you can win trying to just shut everyone down. I mean, when you play in when you try to make a low scoring environment like that, there's a lot of random variation. So I don't think that they're necessarily going to be that great coming down. And Hull's the third team, and Hull. Yeah. I mean, Fulham already like annihilated this whole team once already this year. Hull didn't even look like they should be. I mean, I'm sure it may not have been their complete first team, but they didn't even look like they should be on the same field.
Right.
When they played Fulham. So those teams don't scare me. If I had to pick now, I would say the three teams fighting for it would probably be Norwich, Wednesday, and Fulham again. I think those are the three best teams. Derby and Ipswich, I thought they had good squads, but I have no idea what they're doing with their manager. So they seem to be run by crazy people. So I don't see them.
they are.
I don't see them really challenging. I mean, Villa might finally get things together, but yep. I think they're a very Fulham like club where it's going to take them a couple of years down in the championship to really figure things out. I would be shocked if the top three at the end of the year probably aren't Wednesday, Fulham, and Norwich in some order.
Okay, interesting. And I just want to mention, I think I saw yesterday that Sky Bet has Fulham second right now in their early betting for the league next year, which is awesome. So that's, and again, they're seeing what we're seeing. I agree with everything that you said, Andrew. They should be able to fight for automatic promotion and actually win it. That's the way I'm looking at it. If they do what they need to do, getting the players that they need, they should be able to get one or two. I truly believe that, but there's still a good amount of work that needs to be done. And they need to hold on to their key players and obviously their head coach as well. How about you, David? Can Fulham win automatic promotion?
Well, first of all, isn't it nice that we can actually be asking this question?
Yes, it's
in
excellent.
A serious tone.
Yes.
I mean, you look at the last couple
of... It's a legitimate question this time.
It's a legitimate question, and they do have a legitimate shot. If I go back to when Fulham were in the Premier League, To be honest, I didn't know much about the championship at all. It was never on TV. You know, there was, you know, for the most part, you know, unless it was an FA Cup match or something, I never would even see one of the, you know, championship or, you know, lower league clubs play. And when we went down, I think I felt like a lot of other people, well, we're just going to boss this league and we're going to go right back up. I had no idea how brutal and difficult and competitive this league was. Now, I have thoroughly enjoyed this season. Doesn't mean I want them to be in the championship again, but I have thoroughly enjoyed this season, the level of play, and whatnot. Next year, I'll get to watch every Fulham match streaming. So that's going to be a big change. That's going to be a huge plus for this. But that doesn't mean I want them to stay there. But everything has to – I mean, you look at Brighton. You know, they were winning the entire thing until the last – basically the last game. They just – what, they lose their last three games? Yeah. They had it. I mean, they had the actual championship won. Everything has to go just perfectly. If you look at Newcastle, the winners – they were very good, even though we did the double over them. And you look at, so they had 85 goals for, we had 85 goals. They had 10 losses. We had 10 losses. I mean, you look at these, some of these stats. They had, you know, 45 goals to the good. Well, we had 28. Still very, very respectable. Where we died, they had 7 draws. We had 14. You beef up this squad a little bit. You don't have Newcastle in here anymore because Andrew's right. Sunderland, I mean, come on. They're a train wreck. They looked horrible last season. Sunderland, Hull,
and Middlesbrough.
And Middlesbrough, I mean, come on. I'm not too worried about those guys.
I don't fear any of them. And, you know, it's funny. I've heard people fearing the teams coming down. I don't get it because I don't fear any one of these. I actually see Sunderland – going down a similar path as Aston Villa. And Hull is Hull. I just don't fear them. And Middlesbrough are a team like Norwich that I think can go back and forth, just like Hull City. I don't fear any of them, David.
No. I mean, my only fear about Middlesbrough is, you know, they play to a degree like Reading, is that, you know, they're not going to score, but they're just going to try not to let you score.
They have a different coach now. They're going to have a different coach, yes. And I think that's a factor in all this.
So, you know, you turn those, you know, some of those draws into wins.
Yep.
And I think we have a really, really good shot. I mean, again, you look at the last part, you know, from Christmas on, I mean, I looked at this and I went, all right, let's take a look at this real quick. So January, 3 wins, 1 draw, 2 losses. February, 4 wins, 1 draw, 2 losses. March, 2 wins, 2 draws, 1 loss. And then, of course, April, 5 wins, 1 draw, 1 loss. So if you look at that second half of the year, when Slavisa really got his squad figured out, he knew the other teams better. He knew his own team better. I mean, we ended up with 47 points out of 25 games the second half of the season. You know, that is automatic promotion territory right there. You know,
no, listen, I understand
what,
that.
What's
that,
94 points? That's exactly what Newcastle had.
Yeah.
And they won it. So.
See, I don't think that we're that far off. I think if we do upgrade the positions that you guys are talking about, we keep all of our key players, keep our head coach, there's no reason why we cannot be contending, dare I say, winning either first or second. See it.
I don't want to do playoffs again.
Our history
in playoffs is just not very good.
No, it's not good. It's really a lottery. It's so difficult to win it. That's why I'm looking at ways that they can win automatic promotion, and that's why I wanted to talk about it in that way, and I think that they can. That's why I wanted to pretty much get near the end of the show talking about can they do it, and I think we're all in agreement that they can if yep. things fall their way and if they add the players that they need to add and keep their head coach. I think, well, I think we can have a special season, guys. But listen, before we end the show, I want to talk about something that we talked about offline. There was a very interesting article on Cottagers Confidential. It's called Why I'm a Fan of Fulham FC. It stars Andrew Beck. And Andrew, it's basically your story of why you became a Fulham supporter. So I want you to share that with us. I'm going to share my story, and then David, you can share yours, and that's how we're going to end the show. So Andrew, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, so I didn't really play soccer growing up. I played, I think, up to about U-10s. I was a baseball player. My whole family were baseball players, so that was kind of what I focused on. And I really didn't – I mean, you would see occasionally, you'd see there was a show on PBS called Soccer Made in Germany that you would see sometimes. But basically, you didn't see any soccer on TV until the 1994 World Cup. And that was in the United States, and I was at a really good age. And I remember falling in love. I was with Roberto Baggio. That was I loved that guy in that World Cup. After that, it was you looked around for soccer to watch, but there wasn't a lot of it. I mean, growing up in Oklahoma, sure didn't help with that. I didn't have an MLS. When the MLS started, I didn't have an MLS team near me. So it was kind of every couple of years, I'd watch the World Cup. I'd watch the Gold Cup. But that was all that I did. And then it finally, in the mid to late 2000s, we started getting all of these extra HD channels. And all of a sudden, you have Fox Soccer. And there's just more soccer than you knew what to do with is on TV all the time. And I've got a DVD-R, and I can record it. And honestly, I mean, probably a lot of Americans, I started watching Fulham because Clint Dempsey was there, and they had a history of always having American players. There were a lot of players I knew had been there, and I knew Clint Dempsey from watching the national team, and I really just wanted to watch him play. So I started watching. I really started following him during the Europa League run and through those good years, and became, a really, big fan after that. And then when Dempsey leaves, it was I was just at a crossroads. It's he's why I started watching the club, but there's all these other guys there I like now too. I mean, I think now my all-time favorite player is Moussa Dembele, the first Moussa Dembele.
Right.
The transformation that guy made from being we thought he was going to be a goal scoring forward because of what he did in the Netherlands to, all of a sudden, Martin Jol converts him to basically a holding midfielder. And the change that he made and the way he dribbled, he was just I loved that guy. But then he leaves too. And it's I didn't have the desire to go follow those guys. I fell in love watching Fulham. Even when the football wasn't good, it was so amazing when they would do something unexpected. I think that was just that. The highs you get from that, when I remember even the year we got relegated, though, when we went to Manchester United and they had whatever it was, 500 crosses, and it was Dan Burn heading them all away over and over again. That was actually, empirically, that was a bad football game to watch. That was not good soccer, but it was just a very happy memory for me watching that, going in basically and slaying giants. And I remember the 3-3 draw at Arsenal, where we stopped a penalty in the final minutes to keep the draw. Just games like that are so much bigger when you're a club like Fulham and you're not supposed to even be competing with these teams. And every once in a while, you can just step up and it happens. And I just have so much fun with it. And I could never see myself rooting for a different club now. It's I've had chances. It was when Dempsey left, I could have switched teams. No one would have said anything to me. I mean, I don't hang out with a lot of other Fulham fans here in Seattle. So, I mean, I could have switched teams. No one knew. I could have switched teams when they got relegated. And again, no one's ever really going to know. But it's just something about the club. And then, once you actually get to go to Craven Cottage and you walk around, and at the time I was there, I got to walk on the field. Once you do that, it's just it's not something that I think I could ever do away with. I mean, they're my club. I mean, I follow a club here in in the States because, you know, I like watching soccer. I mean, that's kind of what I do. I watch, I probably watch way too many soccer games. I probably watch, you know, 10, 15 games a week sometimes, but nothing is like watching Fulham to me.
Right.
They're the team I want to watch the most. Yeah, they're my team, and it's I may be 5,000 miles away, but it's when they do something good, it's always going to be a really good week for me.
Yeah, and listen, I'm the same way. And David, before I go to you, my story is similar to yours, Andrew. When it comes to Clint Dempsey, I've said this several times that was my link because he played for the New England Revolution, and he decided to go to Fulham, and I said I'm going to follow him to Fulham because I wanted a team in the Premier League, and they became my team. And for me, it really took when it became Fulham where my team was the Great Escape. I threw myself into that. The Patriots had just lost the Super Bowl to the Giants, and what do? I throw myself into a relegation battle, and it was crazy. But that's when I truly became a Fulham supporter, was surviving the Great Escape. That's when it happened for me, but my initial contact to Fulham was Clint Dempsey. But then it got to the point that, you know, I've had people say to me, how could you still be a Fulham supporter when Clint Dempsey left? How could you still be a Fulham supporter, like you said, Andrew, when they got relegated? It got into my blood. You know, it wasn't about the player. It soon for me had really little to do with it being about Clint Dempsey. He got me there. Then it became about Fulham. And like you said, Andrew, once you've gone to Craven Cottage and you've experienced that, I can't imagine you saying to yourself, you know, changing your mind that you're not going to be a Fulham supporter anymore. It made no sense to me. They were my team, and they're your team as well. And, you know, I met people that have told me that when Dempsey left, they stopped following Fulham. Well, you never were a Fulham supporter. You were a Clint Dempsey fan. Fine, that's fine. But we're different. We are Fulham supporters, and it's in our blood. And that's why these stories are interesting. Your story was interesting. I think mine's fairly interesting. And I'm sure, David, you have an interesting story as well to end the show.
Well, mine is similar as well. I am just a football fan, and back in the day, back before we could see a lot of premiership games, we could see one, maybe two a weekend, and that was it. So you just watched whatever you could. But as we got more channels, more contracts were signed with TV stations around or with networks around here, we began to watch more and more. And of course, I started following Fulham a little bit because, again, they had a number of Americans on it. But I followed them mainly at the time because of Brian McBride. I don't live too far from Columbus, Ohio, and Brian came from the Columbus Crew, who was my local team, and went to Fulham. Well, my wife and I had an opportunity to go to London, and while we were there, I said, we need to see an EPL match. Who's local? Who's playing? What's going on? And she said, well, the only team we've got playing that's anywhere near us is Fulham. And they were at the bottom of the table. It was the Great Escape year, and I got to see them play their last home match of the year against Birmingham City. And they won, and that, for the most part, they had to win the next week, or, well, you know, a couple of different things could have happened. But they won that match, and I have never been more excited and more drawn into a match in my life. My wife still talks about that. I mean, that was 10 years ago. My wife still talks about that match, how much passion there was in the crowd. We were on the Riverside Stand down near the Putney end, pretty decent seats. Sadly, it was on the other end because McBride scored down down at the other end, at the Hammersmith end. So we didn't, you know, it wasn't right by us. But I just couldn't believe how we fell for the club at that time, and I've never stopped since then. And you know, Dempsey's moved on, McBride, Bocanegra, Casey Keller, all these guys have moved on. It doesn't matter. It's the club now. It's not an individual player. And I'm afraid I'm hooked.
I think we're all hooked. But wow, what a great way to end the show, to talk about our stories. And please do check out Andrew's article on cottagersconfidential.sbnation.com. to read about his story. Very interesting tale. We all have our own story, so I thought that would be a great way to end the show. But, guys, it is time to wrap it up. Andrew, thank you so much for doing this today.
Oh, no problem. I had fun like always.
Okay, and David Kettlehake, it's been a long time. Thank you so much for doing this tonight.
Russ, thanks so much. I had a great time as always. Andrew, nice talking to you again, and I hope you have me back soon.
Yeah.
All right, guys, I will have you back soon. We'll continue to do more shows as the Cottagers Confidential Roundtable. I'm sorry it's been so long, but we will be doing more shows, and I will have you guys both back. I look forward to doing that as we look forward to the new season. But it is time to go. For David Kettlehake and editor of Cottagers Confidential, Andrew Beck, I'm Russ Goldman. Thank you, as always, for listening to Cottage Talk.